that's why you now see a further reduction in taxes, is because the assessed values of the properties were reduced. That makes sense.
Not entirely, if I might follow up, Madam Chair. So prior to the 99 Act, the owner of forest land would pay a property tax and a privilege tax and other taxes, I understand, particularly of harvest, but we're talking here about standing value. The privilege tax has been reduced or eliminated.
It will be eliminated by 2003.
Under 3575.
Correct. That's okay. The 99 bill.
And you said that that bill caused the property tax to increase on that land?
I'm Chair Representative Nolan, yes. Going from
20%. But the net, the combined privilege and property tax, which after that bill will now be a zero privilege tax plus some property tax, end up where in comparison to pre-99? Same, above, or lower?
Lower. Lower. I can't give you a dollar amount.
Order of magnitude?
Well, I would have to really, I don't have that on the top of my head. I'd have to go back and look at the revenue impact, which I did for the 99 legislation. Which was, you know, in the tens of millions. My guess, again, I said I can't recall a number, but it's around $20 million reduction, I think, overall.
Statewide.
Statewide.
Follow up? I'm fine for now. Thanks.
Representative Hayden.
I have a lot of questions, but I'll wait. I want to hear some more.
Do you have any more to say?
No. Not even have it. Well, it's really just sort of a philosophical question. You say that property taxes will be at the real market value. And my question, I guess, is what is real market value in the absence of government price controls, i.e. zoning laws on land? Some of that acreage would be worth $50,000 an acre, and nobody could afford to pay the property taxes on that for forest land. But we have an artificial cap in the form of land use laws, which means the value is, what, $100, $200, $300 an acre, $1,000? What is the real market value, the average real market value of forest land?
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, you do have a schedule in the bill, and in fact on page one, which says that the statutory values run from 720 on the best land down to a dollar on basically or land that won't grow. On page four, that schedule is revised so that the values that would be, I guess the Department of Revenue is going to have to come up with values. That's part of the charge that they have. But those values may not exceed the values on page four, which run from 450 on the best land down to $6. On non-productive land. Average, again, is probably around $300 an acre. The charge that the department has is to determine essentially the real market value on forest land, the land whose highest and best use is forest land. And so that's not relevant, in a sense, to the comments that you're making. Where that comes in is designated forest land, land which has a highest and best use, which is other than forest land, other than growing forest. To the extent that that's designated as forest land, then it applies. Then these same values apply, even though, like you say, their residential values or other values may be substantially higher. So that becomes a land use question, in a sense. What you're doing is you're trying to keep those lands in forest production and reducing the tax to achieve that objective.
Well, I don't understand. On page four, I'll take this or page one, say that FA, that's what, Forest A?
What these are, they're called site classes, and they have to do with the productivity of the soil. This is the best land. It'll grow trees to 200 feet in 50 years or something. And as you move down, then the soil has less ability to grow trees and is therefore less valuable.
Okay, well, explain this to me. Say I own 1,000 acres of FA land, and it's assessed at $450 an acre. That means that under property values, it's worth $450,000, and at 15%, that means my property tax bill each year would be $67,500. And the land may have been curb cut 5 years ago. I may have no cash flow at all. How would I pay that?
$6,700.
I think, yeah.
Your property tax would be $15 a thousand.
Why would it be $15 a thousand?
That's the limit.
Yeah, why would it be $15 a thousand?
Well, that's the most it can be under current law.
Yeah.
The Constitution. So you're off by an order of magnitude. Instead of a $67,000 bill, you'd have on a $450,000 value, you'd have a $6,700.
Yes, you're right, because it's $15 per thousand.
Okay. If I may, Madam Chair, it would be somewhat less than that also because of the 15 limit. In general, where forest land exists, you don't have city tax rates. The average rate is substantially below the 15. But whatever it is, the question is still a relevant question. How do you pay for it?
Okay.
And that historically, in 77, when you went to a severance tax, was part of the reason was that you could pay that when you harvested because that's when you had the money. And in 93, when you revised the tax law to essentially exempt standing timber from value, you still chose to collect 80% of the property tax through the privilege taxes. And that, again, the rationale being, two rationales were involved. One, given the change, you would shift the tax substantially among different types of owners, depending on how recently they had harvested. But the other issue was, again, to have money available at the time the tax is due. Clearly, in this case, you're moving back to where you don't necessarily have an income source, which is well correlated, I guess you could say, with the annual tax payments. So, in some sense, first of all, most of the properties are on a sustained yield basis so that you are harvesting some material from the property each year, and you would have a revenue source to meet those tax payments. If not, you end up in a situation where you have to borrow to meet the annual tax payments. You eventually get to a harvest and you pay off your debts. But it's the industry that has come forth and asked essentially that you change from the system where you pay the tax when you harvest and when you've got the money to one where you make annual payments. And that's a price, I guess, of the reductions that they've received in the total property tax, the total tax bill on their operations.
Good answer. Thank you.
Representative Lowe.
Thank you. My question's been answered.
Representative Nolan, did you have a follow-up on your line of questioning?
I don't have a follow-up, but I have something to say when it's time for discussion on the proposal. And the main piece I have to say on the substance of the proposal is this is one of those rare circumstances where my district is virtually unaffected. It has a very nominal financial impact from this bill. But statewide, schools look to lose nearly $20 million a biennium. I would be very supportive if there was a concern about putting the tax responsibility on more appropriate parties and heading revenue neutral tax shift, but I have a hard time supporting something that's going to take $20 million away from our school in a near biennium. Frankly, I'm not comforted by the tactic of putting off the pain by 2 years.
Thank you. Mr. Yates, do you have any comments to lead us with on this?
I guess not, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. If there are no further questions or comments from the committee, we'll let Mr. Yates get back to his work that he does. What I'm going to do is close the public hearing on House Bill 3537, and I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2200.
Madam Chair, I've provided committee members with a copy of House Bill 2200A. We have a recommendation from LFO cover sheet for fiscal impact on the ingress bill. The Legislative Revenue Office revenue impact and the staff measure summary from the House Committee on Ag and Forestry. House Bill 2200 allows the state forester to establish a program for creating forestry carbon offsets on non-federal forest lands. A forestry carbon offset is defined in Section 6 of the bill as a transferable unit based on a measured amount of carbon storage expressed as a carbon dioxide emission equivalent or other equivalent standard and accruing on forest land as live or dead matter in trees, shrubs, forest litter, and soil. And I thought it was important to get that on the record of actually what a carbon, forestry carbon offset is. Section 2 allows the forester to enter into agreements with non-federal forest landowners to market, register, transfer, sell these offsets. Under certain conditions. Section 2 also requires the proceeds from the transfer or sale of offsets be distributed. There's a formula in there that not less than 50% goes to the landowner, not more than 25% to the department to fund programs providing assistance to non-industrial private landowners, and then not more than 25% to fund administration of this program. Section 3 requires the department to establish an accounting system for the program, and Section 4 allows the forester to develop administrative rules to establish this program. The fiscal impact, if you'll note, it has a total expenditures of $69,393 in the 0103 biennium. The agency believes this can be accommodated within their budget, their governor's recommended budget, so it's assumed in the budget. They would use approximately 5 months of work by an administrative specialist one and nine months of work by an NRS three in the 0103 biennium for rule development activities. They don't need additional position authority because they have positions. So basically, there's no fiscal impact. It doesn't require any additional funding. Revenue for this initially would come from a combination of the Forest Resource Trust and the Forest Development Fund. And then in future biennium, once the program is established, they would use the revenues from the sale of the offsets to fund administration of the program. And those numbers are reflected in the fiscal on the 0305 biennium.
Thank you. Questions from the committee on Mr. Rocco's presentation? I'll call forward Mr. Seeley and Mr. Cathcart from the Department of Forestry. Good morning.
Good morning. Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, good morning. My name is Clark Seeley, and I'm the Assistant State Forester for the Department of Forestry here in Salem.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dr. James Cathcart. I'm the Forest Resource Trust Manager with the Oregon Department of Forestry here in Salem.
Thank you for the opportunity to testify this morning on House Bill 2200. This is a bill that was pre-session filed by the governor for the Department of Forestry and the Board of Forestry. And it's a bill that we believe is a framework and really a landmark legislation for the state in terms of the subject of carbon crediting and dealing with concerns related to future health of the air and the environment. It also provides an important mechanism, an incentive mechanism for forest management activities across the state. And in particular, activities on non-federal forest land, either private forest land, industrial or industrial, or state forest land. The bill has worked its way through the House committee, and in that process was amended to the A and Gross version that you have today. The principal changes in the A and Gross version came from further discussions with interested parties about the subject of forestry carbon credits, and in particular, there was interest to further define some of the accounting principles, if you will, in dealing with the subject of carbon credits, and those principles that were added or expanded are shown in Section 4 of the bill, beginning on page 2 and continuing on page 3. It's really an expression of the key principles that are intended to be brought into the administrative rule process over the course of the next 2 years as the Board of Forestry goes through the development of the administrative rules to establish the programs.
I have a question that I would like to ask the agency, and that is the same question I've been asking all of the agencies that have been dealing with some mechanism for incenting environmental benefits for the citizens of Oregon. And that has to do with some mechanism for banking and trading mitigation credits. There's a probably a longer tradition of wetland mitigation banking than any other element in natural resource mitigation. But the watershed councils and the saltwater conservation districts have also looked at conservation easements, tradable, leasable, and sellable conservation easements. We're looking at just mitigation banking for in-stream water rights that may be available from senior water rights holders that are not using all of their water rights in an agronomic way, possibly making them usable as in-stream downstream water rights as a mitigation for somebody that has a water quality problem or needs a mitigation. Carbon sequestering is certainly a big issue, and it's going to get more important as people become believers on the global warming issue. But there are so many different aspects to mitigation banking, yet there is no agency of the state government that I'm aware of that has taken a lead role in mitigation banking for soil, water, air quality, carbon, pollution tax credits, any of the other things that can be banked and traded. We just authorized a bill in the Revenue Committee that would allow air quality credits to be carried forward in the sun. And I guess the question I have for the department is,
why is Oregon taking a piecemeal approach to mitigation banking? Why is there no central clearinghouse for mitigation banking? Why is there no discussion of conversion of mitigable effects? In other words, soil, water, air quality, wildlife habitat, carbon sequestering, all have a relative value that could be convertible from one natural resource discipline to another. If there were a central clearinghouse, if there were a central authority and a central repository for mitigation banking, we've got mitigation going on in Water Resources Department, we've got it going on in Division of State Lands, we've got it going on in Department of Forestry, we've got it going on in Department of Environmental Quality, we got it going on in Department of virtually every natural resource agency, taking a different approach and coordinating mitigation banking. And I want to know why it's not being coordinated and what agency is the agency that should be responsible. You know, obviously the governor's not seen fit to take leadership within the governor's natural resource office to coordinate mitigation banking. And the agency has to meet with each other monthly. Is there no discussion of a coordinated approach to mitigation banking? Kind of a long question.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that's a big question. I'm maybe use an analogy in terms of explaining our department's actions on this topic with respect to mitigation banking or trading with forestry carbon offsets. And I remember an experiment I did when I was a kid where you make rock salt. And the way you make rock salt is you stick a string in the jar and you have some chemicals in there, and then all of a sudden, you know, everything grabs onto that string and coalesces into a finished product. I think your vision is right on, Senator Farrelly. We are probably putting the string in the water, trying to get our piece to coalesce with respect to forestry. That's our area of expertise. I don't have an answer as to why the coordination isn't occurring across agencies, across different tools, in order for landowners to get credit for good, sustainable actions on their land. We're attempting to at least set the tone with respect to carbon dioxide emissions in the forest. And one of the mechanics in this bill, though, is an advisory committee that has representatives from the Department of Environmental Quality, Fish and Wildlife, Conservation Organization, and so that interaction you're seeking will at least be stimulated by this legislation.
Yeah, and Madam Chairman, I appreciate the fact the Department of Forestry is only a piece of the puzzle. The real issue is that the nexus where all this comes together is at the landowner level, and a single landowner that has pasture land and forest lands might deal with a dozen different state agencies in developing a management plan for their land, and each of the dozen different agencies could have some sort of mitigation offering, grants, planning, technical assistance, and none of them that I know of would have any coordinated approach to doing it. But it seemed to me that if there was a mechanism, once a person had the idea of what they wanted to accomplish with their management objectives, to go to a single clearinghouse and learn all of the things that might be available to stimulate mitigation or to manage sustainably. And I'm sorry to see that the procedure hasn't been able to keep the interest of the state agencies enough to get them engaged in a discussion about how they might work together for mitigation. Maybe the idea should have been brought up in January. But every time an agency comes forward, I ask them, what are you doing about mitigation, and are you working with other agencies? The answer is pretty much the same across the natural resource landscape. Yes, we're engaged in mitigation planning. No, we're not coordinating with other agencies.
And I think your point is well taken, that the net result is an incredible confusion and almost an insurmountable bureaucracy at the point that the landowner enters the picture, that mitigation banking is an incredibly confusing undertaking for a landowner to embark on.
And I have the feeling that lots of landowners would participate, but windows of opportunity are opening and slamming shut in dozens of agencies statewide. How's the landowner going to know about the timing, the calendar, and the requirements if there's no central clarity?
Yeah, it's true. Representative Hayden, you had a question.
Yeah, and it will probably be answered at some point in time, or it may be in the half of the material that I haven't read, but you can probably tell me more quickly. If the carbon stored in fuel, if the carbon stored in trees is burned, is the carbon released to the atmosphere, does it remain in a solid form? In a forest fire or in a wood stove?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, when a tree or a forest burns, that is an emitting activity of carbon dioxide back into the atmosphere.
Okay, second question, Madam Chair.
Yes.
If a landowner chooses to plant land, productive or non-productive land with trees, do we lose food crop land then?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that's a possibility that you know, the value of the carbon offsets in planting the trees is sufficient that a landowner would share productive agricultural land suitable for growing trees. That's a possibility. What this bill envisions is, and where the activity that's currently going on with forestry carbon offsets and forestation is what we call underproducing land. And this is land that's marginal for ag, marginal for pasture, or just in brush. And from an economic perspective, we're not reaching the full productive potential of these lands. So so we're not taking away from productive agricultural land. What we're doing is moving idle land or underproductive land back into a forest condition, in which case it's a move just towards greater economic efficiency on use of land, not a trade-off.
Madam Chair, well, that may or may not be the case. However, if there's enough economic activity there, then more and more productive land would be planted with timberland. But it's not my question. Is carbon stored to a greater or lesser degree by annual or perennial grass crops, grains, pasture? Do the grasses store carbon to the same extent the trees do?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, there is scientific discussion going over, which land uses over a long term lead to greater permanent pools of stored carbon. It has been recognized that certain agricultural practices involving no tilling or less tilling really enhance soil carbon storage, and there have been some mitigation deals funding those type of practices or incentives to farmers. The accounting principles in the system is what sorts out which is better than others. I don't think it's a clear case. You'd have to look at the duration, the time frame of interest, and the amount of organic material in the soils. I could conceive agricultural practices on certain soil types being just as competitive to forest conversions on other sites in terms of a carbon accounting of offsets of atmospheric carbon dioxide.
I'm sure a couple more questions. With the grasses and the grains and so on, then does the carbon become transferred to the soil by tilling it in, or does it transmit through the grass, through the roots, and into the soil by some mechanism?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, what we would look for is identifying your carbon pools on the land and the land use. One carbon pool is the buildup of organic material in the soil that occurs as a result of non-tillage. Because when land is plowed, that exposes that carbon to the atmosphere, and it decomposes and releases carbon dioxide. Where forests have an advantage over longer time frames is in the above ground pool of biomass, you know, the tree trunks, the leaves, and if the grasses were used for food production or other activities that society needs, but releases the carbon dioxide in the grass as a result of that use, then that above ground pool would not hold much in terms of the grasses. If the grasses is being used in bioenergy, biofuels type projects where it's allowing not natural gas not to be burned, then that biomass pool could be credited in the grass as a CO2 offset. The same goes with trees. Trees, if they're harvested, there's some disturbance, there's some release of carbon during the harvest activity. But over a rotational basis, especially when you start out with no trees, there's a permanent increase in the biomass from going from non-forest to a rotational forestry a practice.
Okay, well, with the rotational forestry, then I was talking about annual grasses or what their storage capacity was, and then we moved to trees. Now, is there a bell-shaped curve where trees will take up carbon more when they're young and less when they're older? Do they take it up at a steady rate throughout life expectancy? If there is a bell-shaped curve, what's the optimum time to harvest the trees and replant with new ones, with young ones?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the above-ground biomass stored in trees in terms of stored carbon would probably follow the same kind of growth curve that forests grow from young to old. And that's usually a slow start as the trees get established, rapid growth as the trees get anywhere from 20 to 50 to 60 years, and then a slowing in growth as the trees get to what we call in forestry biological maturity. There's a definition we call mean annual increment, and when that's the average growth over the period, and when that's maximized, that is really the maximum biomass volume accumulation in the tree. We normally measure that in terms of commercial products. If we measure that in terms of biomass, it might lengthen our biological rotations. But there is a optimal in terms of the biomass production of a forest, and in which case then that forest can kind of maybe just neutralize, you know, the growth is lost, but it's not accumulating any more net biomass or carbon.
So final question, and thank you for your allowance, Madam Chair. So would our scientific consultants tell us that we should, if we want to create the optimum carbon sink, that we should be harvesting at an 80-year rotation, or is that what I heard you say?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the main thing to keep in mind is that you always have to standardize your starting conditions. The forestation model starts with essentially underproductive land that has low biomass and brush or pasture or some agricultural use. Over time, by establishing a forest on that starting condition, the optimal rotation age for maximizing the biomass in Douglas fir forest may be as long as 120 years. We can do things to kind of push out the growth. Where there's some discussion is that if you start out with a old forest and convert that to a younger forest, does that increase your carbon storage? And it may or may not, because you have to realize the starting condition in an old forest already has the carbon stored, and you know, with old growth characteristics in down wood, a lot of material accumulated stored, and when you harvest that, you disturb that and you release that, and where in some forests, a younger forest may overcompensate for that. Like, for example, on our Cascade Ridge, where we're losing these forests anyway to bugs and everything, that disturbance is going to happen anyway. But maybe on lower elevation, old-growth forests that can persist for centuries in a viable state, disturbance in that forest may not be made up by the younger forest rotation. So you just have to be aware of the starting conditions before you make generalizations about whether younger forests or older forests are better opportunities for carbon storage.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Representative Nolan.
Madam Chair, in the interest of time, I'll pass on my questions if I could make a statement when we go to work session.
Representative Lowe.
Thank you. Does the bill make provisions for the fact that the most highly concentrated carbon deposits, carbon storage, that I know of in the physical world is coal, coal fields? You can't just purchase a coal field and sit on it and then allow somebody to dump a lot of pollution in the air because they're not mining the carbon there. Maybe I'm not getting it.
Madam Chair, Representative Lowe.
That's a separate process from this bill. There is an exception in this bill for?
Madam Chair.
As long as you're talking about biomass.
Madam Chair, members of the committee. This bill does not speak to provisions where atmospheric carbon dioxide levels could be managed by not burning fossil fuels. Those activities are engaged in the power generation businesses. Oregon standard for new power plants really asks companies when they site new power plants to do three things. The first thing they ask them to do is encourage their customers to use less energy. The second thing the standard asks Oregon companies do when they site a new power plant is to use the most efficient technology in producing the energy. Right now, that's moving towards natural gas and burning the natural gas, which is cleaner than coal, so leaving the coal in the ground, and producing two types of energy, electricity, as well as steam. And that steam can be used by another manufacturer, and that manufacturer doesn't have to burn wood or coal to produce that steam, and it's staying in the ground. Third thing that the bill, that Oregon's carbon dioxide standard asks those energies to do is those two things aren't enough, but to engage in independent actions that remove more carbon dioxide kind of independently of their power production, such as forestry activities, and that's what's called an offset. Our legislation deals with that piece as it relates to forests and forest management and recognizes a full suite of activities that may increase the amount of CO2 removed from the atmosphere from forests, it doesn't speak to ways to prevent the use of fossil fuels to begin with, though policy-wide state, you know, collectively in the state, that's very much a piece of the puzzle.
I guess, Representative, no. Thank you, Madam Chair. I suppose that I was just asking in a different way the same question that Senator Farioli asked about aligning some of these banking schemes with other industries. Thank you for that explanation. I'm having a hard time with this concept altogether because I don't see how we can take credit for what the trees breathe in and how they process it, synthesis, to create biomass. I don't see how we can use that as a commodity and allow somebody to purchase the goodness of that so that they can add pollution to the world. I think that's what I'm hearing here, and I'm having a hard time with visualizing this process and why that's the environment. Can you help me out with that?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I am prepared to give a little 4-minute demonstration that's very visual with the use of Legos.
Legos.
If you would like me to kind of walk you through how that works, but
it might help. I'm not proud.
If I need to do that.
Madam Chairman, at the risk of denying the committee the opportunity to see the Lego demonstration, I'd like to try to answer Representative Lowe's question. And that is simply that if you are a landowner that manages your small woodlands for a return on your investment, at some point in time, you're going to want to respond to the market conditions and harvest the trees. But the trees may have more value standing as carbon sinks than they do on the log truck headed toward the mill, especially in those situations where market fluctuations make markets uncertain, and that there may be a time between the offer and the acceptance and the bid and the pound prices change. So many landowners hedging a bet may be interested in leaving their 80-year rotation plan unimplemented for the following 20 years, because that 20-year period might produce as much income for them in the short term on a carbon sequestering offset marketing scheme than harvesting the timber. So it's that 20 years additional timber standing on that land that has value in terms of a carbon sink. So it's that extra increment. The other way to get an increment would be to make sure that people understand that converting marginal lands to forestry or afforestation, getting that ground into the high curve of carbon sequestering, as the young forest is, also may have value. And otherwise, they would not plant a marginal forest land with high growth trees or fertilize or do all the management things they have to do. So they're managing that for the timber, but for the carbon sequestering.
I understand. Thank you. Kind of like buying an acre of Brazilian rainforest to save the planet.
Kind of. Only in this case, I want to see the Legos demonstration now.
Well, if I'm not going to pass up a Lego demonstration, I don't
get
this opportunity every day. So please proceed.
Somewhere there's a 6-year-old who really is sad. Dad's got the Lego.
Well, there's a 51-year-old that's really excited.
I had intended to comment that the appendix was written in elementary school language that I could understand, and I was going to commend them on that, but Legos are even better.
Well, Mr. Rocco informs me that in his knowledge, this is the first Lego demonstration that there ever has been in a
historic moment.
Yes.
We should have the theme from 2001, or that's a spank, is there a thirst or theme in the background?
I guess you can never say wrong by
old
right. Exactly right. You'll never go from oversimplifying to the legislature.
Well, I'm so glad I could accommodate you by asking the appropriate segue.
Okay, the question is no, hang on.
The other visual aid.
One we all understand.
Okay, essentially what the question you're getting at is how do you decouple the commodity that we call an offset from the physical processes that are on the piece of land. So what we have here is our basic Lego cogeneration power plant just being sited here in Oregon. And under Oregon siting standard, like I mentioned, they've already encouraged energy conservation of customers. They've identified their latest technology. They're burning of energy efficiency, but they're still producing carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Now we have a landowner who has an underproductive asset on their land. And the key to one of the carbon accounting principles is that landowner doesn't have the means or the incentive to bring that into production. Maybe the cost is prohibited, or they don't have the money. So left under business as usual, or the baseline is that this land would remain underproductive for extensive amount of time. The cogeneration plant can offer to pay the landowner or cover the costs of the investment to create forests. And the program I manage, the Forest Resource Trust, that's the mechanics of it. The Forest Resource Trust funds 100% of the financing and the land to cover the costs. It's like a venture capital arrangement. The trust is providing the money, the landowner is providing the land, and together we're producing a forest. So just for so the cogeneration plant covers the cost of reforestation. And
I don't think you can do that in here, can you?
We saw it.
And over time, the underproducing asset changes into a nice, healthy, productive, sustainable forest. We can measure, and there's formulas and work that's been done, we can measure the biomass between this and this. And we can also relate that to the other pools we talked to. The carbon accounting system referred to in the bill takes those measurements and documents them on a certificate. And the certificate, what we call a holistic carbon offset, would document that from this activity on 1 acre, 300 metric tons of carbon dioxide equivalent have been accrued on this property. And the specifics of how often do you issue these certificates, at what age of the forest is to be worked out in these principles. But let's leapfrog 100 years from now, we have this forest is established, and the certificate then goes back to the funder as an offset. If we have these markets that allow trading, this person could go and see if he could, I got $5 for it, anybody want to give him 10? And he could pass it on. Because it's the accounting system, the registration mechanisms, third-party verifiers probably come into play, but everything points back to this land that we can go out and see that. So that's essentially the mechanics of these forestry carbon offsets. Hopefully that helps.
So, if I might, the value of the offset, the actual dollar value of the offset is set by whatever the market will set it at?
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee. In the appendix to our testimony, I kind of discuss stages of market development. Right now, we're kind of at what I call a stage three, where these transactions are kind of closed door, negotiated transactions. If we have the policy development in this country or internationally, we may end up having tradable markets or exchanges where you just bring your carbon offsets, what I call the Saturday market, and people look at them, and what they're going to be looking at is the accounting system and to be able to track it back to the land, the quality of them, and they may offer you the going rate for those offsets. That's what I call the fourth stage of market development.
Representative Lowe, did you have a question?
I do have one concern, and that is that, okay, supposing our plant here has made an offset or an accounting for the carbon dioxide that they're spewing into the environment, but what about the other stuff? What about the sulfur and the change in pH and so forth? Is that still, that's not forgiven by paying for forestry land to go into production? That's still regulatable in other venues.
Yeah, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Oregon's carbon dioxide siting standard, which was passed by the 1997 legislature, is really just focused on carbon dioxide emissions and projects that remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, forestry or ag. There are sulfur dioxide emissions trading things that have been developed at the national level that deal with some other pollutants.
And one other question, if I could. Now, we've talked about offsets, which I would assume would be some kind of complicated formula that can account for a one for one CO2 for one CO2 kind of exchange. How are we going to improve things? How are we going to reduce the greenhouse gases if we're allowing pollution to go forward just because they pay for a forest to be planted? Are we going to, do you have the regulatory authority to say, okay, well, we're going to reduce the total number of offsets? Where does the improvement piece come in?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the Board of Forestry, the Department of Forestry, does not have that regulatory authority to a set, like an emissions cap. We're at this stage three level of market development where these negotiating deals are occurring because right now companies are just trying to be proactive to demonstrate that this can work and maybe get public recognition for kind of being proactive on offsetting their emissions. For the stage four market development to work, to have, where we have tradable exchanges and you're bringing them like the Saturday market, the experts feel that you have to, somebody has to adopt an emissions cap. Right now, those discussions to do that internationally through the framework of Convention of Climate Change have fallen down, and we're not looking like we're going to have an emission cap adopted or ratified like under the Kyoto Protocol. Nationally, that's a national discussion whether the United States wants to set its own cap. But at some point, people that has to be set, and I don't think it's foresters that are going to do that. But once that cap is set, then people are running into limits. And then the way those cap works, which has been done with sulfur dioxide, is that they look for individuals or companies that more efficiently can give them offsets. So one firm may go above their cap because they bought offsets from somebody who's below their cap. There has to be some kind of capping thing to really make this gel up as a tradable market.
One last question, I promise. Okay, here it goes. How localized is this? I mean, somebody's going to build a power plant in Oregon and buy credits, carbon dioxide credits, in, say, Wyoming or Idaho or Georgia, but we have to breathe the air here in Oregon. So are there internal limits to the venue that we're talking about within this bill? I'm not sure I saw that.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I represent as well. The internal limits set forth in this legislation really is just forestry activities that what I call are sourced in Oregon, come from non-federal lands within Oregon. The money may come from outside of Oregon, but what we're saying in this bill is that forestry activities that have measurable reductions in carbon dioxide from the atmosphere will meet a quality standard that we can measure it, we can show that it's additional, and also we can show that it's providing the sustainable environmental, economic, and social benefits we want from Oregon's forests. That's what this bill is saying to the world, that if you purchase offsets in Oregon, they're quality offsets. If a power plant in Oregon purchases offsets in Wyoming from Wyoming's forests, those offsets would not be influenced by this legislation. That would be up to that transaction or up to the state of Wyoming if they had adopted similar standards.
Thank you. Representative Nolan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll also attempt to answer some of those questions from the perspective of having participated in the substantive committee discussion of this bill. The bill does not propose to remove other environmental regulations and standards that exist in state law or in federal law or federal regulations. What it does move toward similar to other banking arrangements, mitigation banking that Senator Farioli referred to, is recognizing a standard that producer of emissions has to meet. I think it's pretty well known that if an unmitigated production would be 100% of emissions, the first 50% of those emissions are pretty cheap to eliminate. You can put on scrubbers, you can do energy conservation, as Dr. Cathcart recommended. You can do other mechanisms that are relatively low cost per unit. Eliminating the next 25% and still producing the value, the power, starts to get very expensive on a per unit basis. And when you get up to 90, 95, 98%, the last 1%, they cost you on a per unit basis the same as 10 or 20 of your first mitigations. And I think that's the value of this kind of legislation and the similar legislation that's been approved in other agencies. It allows us as a community to say, instead of paying 20 times for that last 1%, let's pay 5 times and get the same net value in the environment, but at lower societal cost. And that's what this bill is all about in terms of providing, recognizing that the air is in fact fungible. And although I agree that we need to find a mechanism to not have these kinds of banking arrangements conflict with each other from Natural Resource Agency to others, I think of it more as a tool in some ways similar to either use of computers when they were first introduced or use of performance measures when they were first introduced. And I'm perfectly happy at this stage to let a few agencies put their toes into the water, and hopefully either the legislature will require that they learn from each other or the executive branch will find the ones that have been most successful and have the other agencies then follow that lead. But let's let a few of them experiment.
Senator Farioli.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Now, the real genius of this plan, and I think the single salient feature that will virtually guarantee its success, is that finally we'll have found a mechanism to allow forest landowners not to harvest timber in the very same way that we pay wheat ranchers not to harvest wheat and hog farmers not to slaughter hogs. In other words, this actually puts money into the hands of commodity producers that may find either market conditions are unfavorable or simply cannot make it on the ground based on the commodities that they're used to producing. I think this is a great opportunity for people that have woodlands that are underproductive. Later on, I think that'll be an extender for keeping timber on the ranch or the farm on the ground rather than being totally driven by market conditions and timing. Good opportunity.
Representative Hayden.
Well, as I remember, the gross figures, there's 60 million acres of land in Oregon, of which 30 million is harvested. Is forest, am I close?
Close enough.
Okay, of which 15 million is, 15 or 20 million is federal lands, which we're not going to harvest anyway. So we have 30 million acres of trees already in place scrubbing the air, 30 million acres of land with grasses or something that's not so effective. Now, do we get our value based on what Senator Farioli says by planting underdeveloped land or extending harvest times on already harvested land? Or does your power company just go out and buy pollution credits on an existing stand that's already there scrubbing the air?
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, members of the committee, I'm going to just back up one sentence. What's motivating this legislation is the Board of Forestry and the department's really overall mission, and that is to promote healthy, productive, sustainable forests on all ownerships in Oregon. What we would like to, I think where this legislation fits in, is that a landowner that looks at their land and is managing all their resources through a management plan in a coordinated fashion, based on what they want to do with their land, their values, and their objectives, are going to be faced with some economic trade-offs. Because, you know, if you hold timber, you're losing potential revenue and so on and so forth. This legislation comes in as accessing or help cultivating a market to help compensate for some of those trade-offs. So when I decide to hold on to my trees and have older forests for scenic or recreation or wildlife benefit to me as a landowner, this bill recognizes that that action by the landowner also is creating an environmental benefit in terms of CO2 storage that's in demand by our energy industries, and then the landowner can get compensated for that. So that's the context of how I see this supporting what the landowner wants to do. The quality assurances and some of the amendments were designed to keep that as the focus and not get so myopic in creating carbon pools on forests that we lose sight of that bigger picture. So it's an incentive piece to help landowners go where they would like to go anyway.
Well, why isn't the 30 million acres already doing the job? And if we planted all 60 million acres, would that do the job?
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, members of the committee, in order to be a marketable commodity, the policy of environment that's emerged, and it's really come out of the international discussions, is that the activity has to be something different than what otherwise would occur under normal circumstances. From the national accounting perspective of the United States and where are we at in terms of our carbon budget, all these acres of forest land can count because they're doing things that are helping, you know, taking, you know, the atmosphere CO2 being worse. The next step is that can we stimulate additional activities that actually lower the baseline? And that requirement of additionality, what otherwise would not occur without this kind of investment, is what makes this the commodity marketable. So to the extent that there's opportunities through investment on these 60 million acres to increase the carbon storage ability of those forests, then what would normally occur based on what's required by law or current investment practices, that's where, you know, the activity would be counted as a marketable commodity. What we're trying to establish through this legislation is that from this point forward, or as landowners develop these plans, they should be recognizing, the ideal thing we want to do is reward those who have already taken these steps and set their baseline to where it was and they didn't realize there was an opportunity for them, but that activity should be rewarded and be able to get money. That's a wicked policy discussion of how you do that. It's baseline management, but anything that landowners are doing through their own means above and required by law potentially could be creditable under this legislation. Where we end up will be a function of the rulemaking and the public discussions about that.
Chair Morgan, we had this conversation in the Ag and Timber Committee, I think, probably, what, two or three times at the Board of Forestry when I was there. I enjoy all the input. I'll go back just a minute to the issue of old growth and their ability to hold carbon as a sink compared to young growth forests. The one thing that we didn't talk about is that every tree is going to die. We're not even on the earth. Every tree is going to die eventually. And the demise of that tree, whether it's by fire and decay, disease, or if it's harvested, determines how much of that carbon gets released back into the atmosphere. And it goes by different rates by how much is left in the remaining product and how that product, if it's in a building that stands for 100 years, then it's still captured for that 100 years. Simply because the tree's cut, that whole amount isn't released. So actually, a fire probably releases more of it back in the atmosphere than the other way. There's a lack of willingness to use this proposed system, which I think is great. There's a consequence to that, and that consequence is that energy is going to become more scarce, energy will become more expensive, and in the end, we're going to have to make decisions that maybe later on will be much worse than we're having to make now, because we have more options at this time using a system like this to learn from it. I think it's great for society. I think we'll find we did the right thing, and as we move along, I think we'll find opportunities to better understand it and to use it.
Further comments by the panel? Questions?
Thank you very much, Sheldon. The Lego demonstration will go down in history.
It will.
We finally found a way to take the second law of thermodynamics and turn it into taxable income.
Is there anyone here that didn't sign up to speak on House Bill 2200 but would like to speak on the bill? If you would, please come forward at this time. And I don't see a stampede up to the front of the room. I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2200. We are in the regretful position of not being able to get another senator to attend any work sessions.
Classified section of the newspaper. Check under the bridge.
We've done all that. They're all accounted for. They just aren't able to be here. So what we are going to do is close this meeting and go into work session on these bills first thing tomorrow before we open the public hearing on the two bills that we have scheduled. Mr. Rocco, do you have anything to add?
No, Madam Chair, except that those other two bills are House Bills 3956 relating to pollution effluent trading, I believe, reduction plan, and then House Bill 3948 related to the natural resources enhancement, including a sustainability board.
Got to get a priority bill there.
Having no further business before the committee, the meeting is adjourned.